think about all the great horses that have been trained here and that have run on this. There's 5 classics run in the UK every year, and 2 of them are held here.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said to people that our job is to set the stage, to let the actors perform, and we want the superstars to show what they are, both, you know, human and equine. So for me to be just a tiny part of the organizing around allowing those superstars to shine is what makes it special.
I'm the Wine Tipster, and welcome to my podcast, serving up the best in racing, food and wine. In this episode, we're in Newmarket at the home of flat racing, and we start off on the Rowley Mile course, one of my favourite race courses in racing. And I'm delighted to say that we walked down the course with Andrew Morris, head of racing at Newmarket Racecourses. A really, really great chat there. And after that, I thought it's time for some food and drink. So we headed off to the Tap Room, a celebrated cafe and restaurant in the heart of the town, where I had a great chat with the proprietor, Paul Winchester. And joining us as well was my good friend, Damien Adams, East Region head chef at Jockey Club Catering, came along for some chat as well. We had a really, really great time, and I really enjoyed chatting to the guys about food and wine, as ever. This podcast is being released the week of the Craven meeting. I love the Craven meeting, which is the opening fixture of a Newmarket's illustrious annual racing calendar. Now, one thing for me, if you haven't visited Newmarket yet, hopefully this podcast, I hope it does, will make you want to come on down, either for the Craven itself or for some of the other wonderful delights the town has to offer. As we were strolling down the Rowley Mile on a bright but breezy morning, looking down the course at the huge mural painted on the side of the building, Andrew told us why he felt this was a special place. Cheers, everybody.
This is not the best venue in the world for spectating. You know, you have to say that. You know, they start a mile and a half away from you.
Yeah.
They race towards you. You know, we're such a wide track. You know, you're a little bit away from it. It can be cold. It can be windy here. But, you know, there's a reason why, as I say, there was a reason why horses have been trained here for so long and been so successful. And there's a reason why horses have raced here. And the greatest athletes in our sport have run on what we're walking on now. So it's a great combination of it's the facilities that have been provided. And that's to do with the amazing ground that we have here and the makeup of the ground, which is so great for thoroughbreds to be trained on. So that's everything from the amount of rainfall we have to the type of grasses that we have to the soil structure that we have. It's just an incredible facility to allow horses to be trained. And as I say, there's a reason why horses have been trained here for so long.
So it's almost like if you're comparing to wine, we are in Bordeaux.
We really are. You're right. I mean, I remember I had been to Bordeaux, and the amazement of when you go from one winery to another, you can see all those names at the end of the drives.
Yeah.
And that's the same in Newmarket, isn't it? When you go around and you see the yards and you see John and Thady Gosden, you know, William Haggis, all those amazing yards. For someone who's a fan, it's like being a kid in a sweet shop, isn't it, in Newmarket?
Totally. And I think that's what I love. And I think it's just also what you were just saying, why it happens here? Why does it work?
I mean, we have amazing heathland grasses here, which have been here for thousands of years. And they provide an amazing cushion, I think, for a horse to train. They're a very kind surface for a horse to be trained on. That alongside the lack of rainfall and the fact that the ground allows the rain to drain through provides great training conditions year round.
And for you, and just in terms of year round as well, you know, as head of racing and clerk of the course, because you've been out in Australia.
So I spent 2 years in Australia and most of that time at Moonee Valley. It's interesting that I've worked in this industry for over 20 years now. And seeing Animo win the Cox Plate is probably the greatest day's racing I've ever had.
Really?
To work on that course, yeah. It affected me more than any other race day I've had.
Why was that?
The atmosphere.
And what was different about that atmosphere?
20,000 people who were just absolutely as one engaged in that single race. Yeah. And the build-up to it was absolutely fantastic. And it was such a privilege for the Moonee Valley Race Committee to give me that opportunity as, you know, an outsider from the UK who'd come without any knowledge of Australian racing.
Yes.
To be in that position to be there was absolutely incredible.
We're walking down the Rowley Mile and you can just get the emotion walk of what that really means to you. I think that's fat. I love all that.
Can I ask you a question? Are they the bushes? Is that the bushes?
Yeah, they're the famous bushes, aren't they? So How exactly would you describe them?
Well, I mean, they're very well cut.
No, I mean, it's a very famous part of the racing surface, because it's seen as being the crucial part of any race, I think, on the Roadie Mile, is when they reach the bushes. And it's seen at the point at which they've seen huge amounts of horses accelerating, and races have been won or lost at this point. So it's known as a very significant kind of part on the track.
Hence the use in commentary.
And it's about 2.5 furlongs out from the winning line. So, and again, that's what makes the Roadie Mile so special, is those undulations.
Yeah.
It's a big open kind of space, isn't it? Mm-hmm. As we stand here. Yeah. And they talk about a horse getting lost a little bit. And I think you can see that you have to be mentally strong.
If you've not been to the Roadie Mile, you know, it's pretty big and it's pretty open. But let me tell you something, it's really worth a visit. I love it. We then got into a bit of discussion about the differences between the July course and the Roadie Mile in Newmarket. The soil, the grass, the weather. Andrew picks this up.
The Roadie Mile kind of dries out a lot quicker. You can almost, if you're in a spell where you're irrigating, you can almost see the water just kind of disappearing. The July course holds that moisture a bit more. So that's the main kind of difference between the two.
But it's interesting, because it's like if we had wine, you'd have got soil characteristics.
Yeah.
And you might have one great variety planted on the Roadie Mile. Different one, a July course.
Yeah.
Might have some Pinot Gris there and some Chardonnay here.
Yeah.
What about, do you feel, in terms of irrigation, sustainability, about that, in terms of how you're communicating about that and when to water the course? Excuse the pun, but do you feel a lot of pressure on that? Or we're going to have sometimes some quite situations, even when the forecaster is going to do this, it doesn't always do it, does it?
You can't please everyone. And you have to make the decisions that you make based on the processes that you think are the right ones to do.
Okay.
And that's based upon preparing the course to what the BHA general instructions ask us to prepare it to. Yeah. And we make the decisions based on preparing what we think is the best racing surface. You don't do that for one horse. Yeah. And as long as you're making consistent decisions that you're communicating effectively, then that's all that I think you can ever do. And the thing is, you will get it wrong, because the nature of our weather forecasting is so tricky that there will be days when the forecast will be wrong and we're basing our decisions based on a forecast. But someone once told me, I think, you know, as long as you can sit back at the end of the day and you're happy with the decisions that you made at the time, that's all you can ask. Right. So that's what the team and I, whenever we sit down to think about making those decisions, do you feel the pressure? Yeah, of course you do.
Yeah, but do you suddenly wake up in the middle of the night about it, even when it's, let's say it's during the Guinness Festival, or I'm sensing we've got to be disciplined here, we're going to do this?
No, you're second, third, fourth questioning constantly. You'll have a conversation with the trainer who will suggest one course of action, and you know, you'll reflect and think, have I done the right thing? Should I? And then another trainer will have a different view. And so that's why you have to be very clear in your own mind about why you're making the decisions that you're making.
And also, we're just kind of, just to say, where we're walking out, we're kind of climbing towards the finish, aren't we? Let's say it's a Cambridge, because that's 1 mile, 1 furlong, isn't it? Do you think a horse at Newmarket needs to really get 1 mile, 2 furlongs, for example? Would you think, because of the nature of the course, because you've got the slam, and because of the way the Roadie Mile is?
I think it's a stiffer uphill finish than a lot of people give credit for. And actually, the finish on the July course is even stiffer again, you know, that final furlong. But I do think that here, you can almost kind of freewheel as you go down the dip.
Yeah.
But then it is a real kind of test as you then go back up, because you're constantly climbing back up to the winning post.
And as we're just doing this, we're just actually, if you look across the left, you've actually got the main grandstand here. So I'd actually be on the third floor in Champions Gallery Reference. I know you're talking about the head on, but I like the head on.
Do you?
Yeah, I really like it, because I think the nature of this course, I love to see the horses spread across the course. Yeah. When you've got a race like the Cambridgeshire, the Cesarewitch, which I'm absolutely crazy about.
Yeah.
Because it's 2 miles, 2 furlongs, but seeing 34 horses coming down the Roadie Mile and that head on piece.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So I do always communicate that and say to, look, you need to take this in. This is special. And because you just sort of go, see how open it is here. The one of the things I was going to say, now I'm thinking about applying for a clerk of the course job.
Okay.
The only bit of experience I've got is working in a garden centre.
You just need a good team, man, don't you?
Yeah, you know.
you just need a good head groundsman or estate manager. So we have a team of 12
right
here, which are full-timers. incredibly passionate. Alan Hatherley is estate manager here who's been here over 20 years.
Oh,
and, you know, I'd be hugely guided by his experience and his knowledge and his passion, you know. And I think when you go back to that conversation about irrigation, our relationship and the trust that exists between the two of us is really important. And I think you'll find that on any race course, because the discussion around the decisions that you make, it's great to have someone who you can bounce ideas and things off. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
If you're walking up here on race morning, when you walk the course, if you're marching down here, not that we're marching because we're walking race here, but what are you looking for, like, as you walk along here?
So I know it sounds silly, but you're looking at different things all of the time. So if you're walking it on a race day morning, you're looking for whether ground conditions have changed since your last update. So whatever weather you've had the night before, what you're going to have during the day, have ground conditions changed? And do you need an update conditions? You're also looking at things like, is all the running rail in place? Is all that in place? Is the winning line as we come to, is that in place? Is all that set up correctly? You know, on a race day, you have a lot of press, photographers. Has anyone put a camera that they shouldn't have? Has anyone put something underneath the rail that they shouldn't have? Is there a piece of litter somewhere? Even going back to, you know, we all make mistakes. Has someone left a piece of machinery somewhere, or a, you know, a hand tool or something that they shouldn't have? And then also you're looking at the actual sward itself, so the actual grass, and you might be thinking about how you're going to maintain that, particularly if it's during a multi-day meeting. You know, will you need to water it? What sort of things really need to do overnight? So there's a kind of whole multitude of things that go through your head. And I guess the more experienced you become, the more that you're just naturally ticking those things off in your head.
So what about the going stick? Just for listeners here, explain a bit about that, because somebody might come in, what are we talking about here? What does this all mean?
Yeah, so we use two main tools in which way that we give the going. So the first one is you're using a kind of old-fashioned walking stick.
Yeah.
And what you're doing then is you're pushing it into the ground and feeling the resistance that you feel. And that is the hardest thing to explain to someone from outside is that someone says, well, do you just do it on how far it goes in? Mm. But everyone's walking stick's different. So so what that is that's through constantly walking a race course and feeling how it's changing. And then what you're doing is you're comparing the amount that it's that you what you're feeling to the feedback that you're getting from a race day.
Okay.
And that's giving you an idea of what you should call the ground. What we then have is we also have an electronic going stick, which is made by a company called Turf Tracks.
Okay.
And what that does is it measures two things, really. I'll probably get this wrong, they'll shout at me, but it measures penetration. So it has a probe, but it measures how easy it is to go into the ground. And then it measures the shear, so you pull it back. Okay. And that gives you a number, which is on a scale of 0 to 15. And so we use that number to correspond to a going. So we've done thousands of readings here over the years.
Yeah, sure.
So when we do a going stick, and a going stick reading may come out and say, oh, that's 7.2, we know we have a scale of where that sits. So you're using a combination of the two. It's actually, it's been an incredibly cold spell recently, the last month or so, and it's been very dry. And we had some rain over the weekend. So actually, we're just pleased to see the amount of grass growth that we've had over the weekend. And it looks like, you know, spring is, touch wood, finally here. Mm. It's very difficult, because what we found is that it's very hard to compare readings between courses.
Yeah.
So we would do a going stick here and publish a reading of 7.2, for example. That 7.2 would be different to what ground conditions are on a 7.2 at Haydock, for example. So at Newmarket, we know that, for example, between 7.6 and 8.5 is kind of good to firm. And for us, that would be what we would think as being that kind of sweet spot of where we would like our ground to be.
That's a great answer. And now let's think about, you're going to do the Craven meeting. You've got the Guinness Festival coming up in the days afterward. Just thinking, when you've got to the end of a festival, so what would be your drink of choice?
Either a pint of Guinness probably would be the first drink.
Okay.
And then maybe some wine after that.
And what colour wine?
So I would be a big Pinot Noir fan. So I would either have there's two probably. So Glutter and Stars, which is Cambridge's only urban winery. So amazing guy called Chris. So he was a music, he's a music journalist, and he now makes wine in the basement of an old windmill in the middle of Cambridge.
Brilliant.
Sources grapes from the UK.
Yeah.
So he does an incredible Pinot. Or
how did you discover him?
So my girlfriend's a big wine fan.
Okay.
So through that, or secondly, it would be probably Pinot from the Mornington.
Yes.
Melbourne, probably Scorpo.
Yes.
Again, there's a guy called Paul, who's the winemaker down there who owns Scorpo.
You had a couple of different Pinot Noirs. What about foods?
A plate of chicken shawarma and rice from a Lebanese takeaway somewhere. How's that? That would be my food.
Chicken shawarma and Pinot Noir.
Yeah, why not?
1, 2. Hello, Coley. Have you heard about the new rap song, Coley Sustainability? I'm here with Damien Adams, head chef at Newmarket Racecourse. And in actual fact, we were meant to have a sort of script where we've been the script, okay? Because we actually prefer just to have a chat, really, don't we? But just for everyone, I think it's interesting just before we talk about some food, but also you, and how long you've been at Newmarket and how important it's been for you.
I love it. 20 years. But they've all been good. They've all been good. And I absolutely love the job. Yeah. You know, there's always something different going on. There's, you know, this because you have the two courses, you're never kind of stuck in the same place for too long. So it is a brilliant place to work.
I'm getting excited now because of the Craven meeting's coming up. Spring is here. I'm looking forward to having some great food. But with the spring season this year, say, for example, in the Champions Gallery restaurant on the third floor of the main stand, which is a great vantage point for the racing. What have you got lined up this year? What can I look forward to? Because I'm coming every day.
Well, there's definitely enough choice there to keep you enticed for the whole for all 3 days. I think probably my top pick starter would be the chicken Kiev. It's done with a white onion and garlic soup, pickled shimenji mushrooms. The soup is poured over the Kiev at the table. That is a showstopper.
Well, I'm placing the first order for that.
That's my way to start. So we always try and do our soups with a bit of show to them, you know. So we like do a really nice garnish and, you know, foods, meats, whatever it's going to be within the bowl, and then pour the soup actually at the table. It just adds a real different sort of element to the soup, you know, instead of it just being a bowl. So you get the best of both.
Do you know what? I think I better come to every race day at Newmarket. I could eat soup. I could have soup every day. So what else have we got to look forward to?
So we also have the roast lamb, which this year, instead of adding the usual potatoes, we've gone with a mac and cheese.
What?
So yes, we have a slow cooked lamb mac and cheese. It's got a pea puree, some lovely fresh spring vegetables, and a lamb jus. Yeah, that would be my pick. But then also on the main, one of the dishes that I really loved creating this year, where we tried to really bring in the sustainability side of the business, we've actually gone for something quite different. You know, some people may say, when you say Coley on the fish dish, some people might say, oh, is that a bit of a cheap cut?
Really?
We've been looking into this. Yeah. It's not overfished. You can get some huge fish which come in and which we cut ourselves. And to be honest with you, I'm finding it just as good as the cod.
So what's special about Coley for you?
Coley, it's got huge flakes. It is literally, it's just like cod. It's not quite so bright white, but the flakes are just the same. The fish tastes pretty much the same as cod. There's some great fish out there that's not known to people, and we should really all be using them as much more than we currently do.
Because I've been buying Coley for years. But I have. I mean, thinking, why are people not enjoying Coley more? You know, but it's great.
Yeah, it's a great way for us all to be going, you know, let's save our environment and do our bit and still get great quality produce.
And how important is that, you know, now with sustainability? How much is that at the forefront for you in what you're doing when you're thinking about creating a new menu? I know seasonal as well, thinking about colours on the plate, but for you now, how much has that changed even within the last 5 years?
There is a massive focus around sustainability, all of that type of stuff. I mean, we're using mussels a lot. Monk's beard is also featured in this dish.
What is monk's beard?
Monk's beard is a bit like, I suppose the best way to describe it would be like samphire.
Oh, okay.
It's like a fine, strandy samphire, yeah. Yes.
It looks...
Yeah, it's really nice. Slightly salty, not quite as salty as a samphire. But yeah, it's still very, very nice, full of nutrients, really, really good for you. So that dish is like super, super sustainable.
You know, extending on from that, and we were just saying how much time and how important it is and how much you're into this in terms of finding, working with suppliers, new suppliers, but also what you're actually doing on course as well. And talk to us about the roof garden.
This has been quite a stressful project, just getting it across the line. But so what we've done is we have replaced all of the cold storage within the catering compound area. And I've turned the largest one, we've now have fabricated a stainless steel rooftop garden, which is going to be planted with like grasses, your general kind of stuff that you would generally see on a rooftop garden. It's quite low maintenance. That's going to be in the center of it.
Okay.
Where we can actually access it safely around the edges, so we're sort of a meter in, like all the way around, we're going to be planting violas, edible flowers.
Yes, of course.
So we can then use these within our dessert garnishing, afternoon tea garnishing, and just adding a little bit more life into this, you know, into the concrete area in the catering yard, and just brings on more well-being for the staff. You know, the staff get to go and pick their own flowers to put on the desserts or the afternoon tea. So yeah, it should be really, really good. I'm really, really excited for it.
Damon, I love your energy because every time, you know, we've done lots of things together over the years and there's always something happening. There's always some new thing you're talking about or something else you want to push forward. You're always moving the show forward.
We are working on a jockey club garden.
Okay.
So we have a poly tunnel coming. Not that we're ever going to be able to cover all the vegetables for a race meeting. But hopefully we can make a change and we can bring some homegrown goods into the kitchen, whether it's herbs, some smaller vegetables, garnishes.
Yeah.
It's coming. Absolutely love it. Yeah. Staff love it. We're putting in a bay tree today. We have apple trees going in. We have pear trees going in. Yes, it might not happen instantly. A lot of it is for the future.
Yes.
You know, everything takes time to grow, but there is definitely certain things that we can be putting in there this year. You will be seeing some of our own homegrown on the menus this year.
Damon Adams says it all. Oh, wow. Come on, it's all coming in here. That's great. This is great. Yeah, we're going to do a bit of sort of sharing, right? Yeah, do a bit of sharing. Here we go. Got the calamari. They got the brownies. Great. Stuff. Oh, look at this. Stuff and camembert. Wow. That looks great.
Yep. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. It's exciting because you always got loads of enthusiasm. Actually, when you were talking about the Coley, I was just thinking about this wine here because we've got this Craggy Range Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
Yeah.
From Martinborough, right down in the south of North Island. So not in Marlborough, Martinborough. Ooh. So, and this is Craggy Range, a very famous producer, actually, in New Zealand. And this is from Hall Garten Novum. They're the importer. And they are the new partner with the Jockey Club for the whole wine list. And they've got a big, big, big range. I've known it for years, actually. Oh, thank you. We've got some calamari coming out. Great. And I thought you'd like to try Sauvignon Blanc. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting because it's not Marlborough. Marlborough's got great Sauvignon Blanc, but actually from Martinborough. And Craggy Range also do some really smart reds as well. But it's great to have Hall Garten Novum on board. They've got some really extensive lists. So it's been a great time actually tasting the raw wines and getting a new list out as well. But this would go great with the COVID.
Yeah,
because the acidity is here. It's just good match. It's got enough weight to it as well to enjoy it. I mean, Sauvignon Blanc has been a remarkable piece in New Zealand. In 1973, there was a guy called Frank Jukic, who does sound like a bit like a footballer who's come on the Match of the Day program, I have to say. But he planted some Sauvignon Blanc in Marlborough, the top of South Island. And people said he was crazy. It won't work. There were a lot of sheep about. It took about 4 or 5 years to get good commercial fruit. And once people had a chance to taste this first Sauvignon Blanc, they just went, wow, that's amazing. People love that style, that sort of dry style, really super fresh. But it's interesting to think that Sauvignon Blanc is just not about Marlborough or South Island. It's also about North Island as well. And Craggy Range is Sauvignon Blanc from Martinborough, right down south of North Island. It's really stylish for me. And that's just something people forget, actually. They kind of go, New Zealand, Sauvignon Blanc, that's great. I really like it. I really enjoyed it on Friday night, but there's a lot of really stylish Sauvignon Blancs out there now coming from New Zealand. And this is one of them. I really like that. How's the cheese going, don't we? So your spring menu for the Craven meeting and the Champions Gallery, you've got lots of talks about the lamb. And just from a dessert point of view as well, what can I look forward to thinking about it? I put myself in for all 3 days to crave.
We've covered off everything from fruit to chocolate to citrus. You know, there's something for everyone. That's kind of how I sort of always, when we're putting together the menus, the choice menus, is you've got to have a chocolate. You've got to have something citrusy for some people that want something light and just a palate refreshener. You need some fruity.
See that, yeah. So the Champions Gallery, the third floor, you've got great view of the head-on racing down the racing that come down that Rowley Mile. But what about if you're not booked in the Champions Gallery, you're going to come along with some mates, party people, you're coming on course. Where's the best place for everybody to go to? What's happening?
It depends really what you're looking for, really. I mean, that was me on a cobbly start outside in the boulevard area. You know, have a few drinks there and then venture inside and up to my hospitality suite. I was lucky enough to have one.
To that, and actually, one of my favorite, I have to say, just talking local suppliers, Pouters sausage is, which I know I'm crazy about. Pouters. I'm crazy about.
Let's see, we're musts here, I'm afraid.
Oh, musts actually have a raw warrant.
They do,
yeah, they do have a raw warrant. I should just say at this moment, the fab Paul Winchester, proprietor of the tap room, arrived at the table, so we mic'd him up for this conversation. Why not? So we're in the tap room. Describe where we are and what you have around us.
So St. James's Palace, the National Horse Racing moved to this site in 2016. It was originally just beside the Jockey Club in what is still called the subscription rooms. St. James's Palace across the road, there is allegedly a tunnel from the basement there that runs to Nell Gwynn's house, where he used to at some point during the evening. And this was an old racing yard. So this was Bruce Hobbs' racing yard and back in the day. It extends over 5 acres. So the Rothschild Yard, which is behind us, it was the Rothschild family. Mrs. Rothschild insisted there is a fountain, which is why there's a fountain in the back of the yard. And it's still a working yard. So they still have horses here. And then this whole site, which was, as you can see, the old stables here, was developed into an exhibit space with the restaurant, with the gift shop that sits at the beginning of the atrium. And then the bakery over here, which is just sort of grab and go. We do have, you know, whole loaves of bread that we don't actually make. They come from a bakery in Cambridge. And it just lends itself to trying to hit the brief for every person who might come through the door, whether they be a visitor to the museum or they just want to come here and have a nice lunch. And when we close on a nice sunny summer's afternoon and we get to the latter part of the day and we close the big gates, you wouldn't know that you were, you know, 100 yards from Newmarket High Street. I mean, you could be just about anywhere. And it's a beautiful place. So this was Sanziano Pinigrigio Rose. You know, a lot of eyebrows were raised when it first went on the list because it is from Romania, okay? But it's made by an Aussie and an English guy. They've invested an awful lot into process. Their bags are all stainless steel, so it's very clean. Last year's vintage or the previous vintage was 11%. This is 11.5%. So it's a great summer drinker, you know. It's my sort of house barbecue-y at home. Nobody's going to turn their nose up. You throw some ice into it to sort of, you know, dilute it slightly.
It's interesting you just say that about ice and wine, because some people say to me sometimes, are we allowed to have ice and wine? Look, do what you want to do and enjoy your own experience. That's the whole piece there. But it's interesting what you said about Romanian wine, because I feel like Romania has been talked about for a long time and there have been really good Pinot Noirs as well. That rosé is great.
It's quite interesting when you get people, you know, and as you get to know people, you'll know the same thing.
Yeah.
You'll get them to taste things that they might sort of look at a list and say, well, I'm not going to touch that. Actually, and I've had some very snooty, I only drink Provençal rosé. And as that has, you know, increased in price, you know, some of them now, you should give them a half a glass of that around, you know, sitting on the grass at Tats or sitting out here in the sunshine on a, you know, warm Friday afternoon. It's like, that's actually all right.
There's not much you couldn't pair that with, to be honest.
Exactly right. And actually, yeah, I think it goes quite well with the cheese, which is quite rich in the garlic and the bits and pieces. But as I say, anything burnt off a barbecue.
Yeah.
You know, on a sunny afternoon.
And it's even got the fruity notes that come through. You could eat them. You couldn't, it wouldn't go wrong with a dessert.
No.
All the strawberries and cream.
And some of those, the lower alcohol wines, I always find are a little bit sweet. Whereas I think that is still
fruity and dry. I mean, it's not bone dry, but it's dry enough.
I think it's dry enough. And I think rosé, people forget about rosé with food sometimes and think how good it is with food. You know, just back to the race course for a moment, is you've got the Craven coming up. We talked about Devil's Diet, but also you've got the Guinness Festival coming up, which must be good for your business, I'm sure, Paul. 3 days of top racing, two of the 5 3-year-old classics. Let's remember that, with 2,000 Guinness and 1,000 Guinness. And we have Michel Roux coming.
Yes, once again, this will be our 10th anniversary with the Roux in the Champions Gallery. Emily has also just been granted her first start, which is all good. It's great working with Michelle and the team. We do it every year. I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun for our team as well to work with them, learn some new skills, just work with some different people. It is really good.
I think he's great. And actually, I think that the whole family is great. I'm so pleased Emily's got her star now. And that's brilliant. And we did a piece of Michelle recently. He was talking about not only how proud he is of his daughter, but talking about his dad, Albert, yeah, who was such a great character. And they've been so influential. And I think what's great is it's all happening. At Newmarket when there were 3 generations of Roux in one kitchen.
Right.
You don't forget that, do you? No, you obviously don't forget that. You just go, wow.
So what we always do on the day before the first event day, we always go out for dinner. Just a pre-service dinner.
Okay.
A couple of nice drinks. But that is something that we started with Albert, you know, and we always used to take turns. But it was just a thing before we went into that first event day, you know, before we're going to knock out that 300 covers, you know.
That's an experience. Working alongside that name, yeah, at these events is something that you may never again see for the rest of your career.
Exactly.
Actually.
It's definitely a massive point. We always involve the local college. We even bring in Newmarket Academy, the school in here, yeah, Newmarket, where I've taken, each year I take 2 students that are interested in food and cooking, to work in the kitchen. So they work alongside the routine. And there's been several occasions now over the last few years where we've actually managed to keep those staff on and they've continued to work for us.
First time I came to one of the tasting sessions for Shea Roux at Newmarket, and it was the first time I met Emily. And Emily had come up with one of the dishes. This is a few years ago. And I'm not just saying this because it's easy to say that sort of thing, isn't it, in that situation? But I remember I tasted this just thinking, wow, that is really amazing. And it just, and Emily and Michelle was very clear to say, look, and Albert, Emily's created this. This is her show. I just really like their approach. They're so approachable as well. And I actually also think chefs just want to have fun and in some ways be a bit more relaxed about things. And Michelle loves that. It was a bit more informal. I feel there's a more of a thread on that now.
But that's what it's all about. And that's kind of what we were saying before. It's like a family affair, you know, with working in catering, you know, and you're all together. You have to be in it together to make it work, to make the service work. The service doesn't work if they're not in tune with what the kitchen are doing, and vice versa. You know, everyone has to work together.
You get much more out of people if you actually communicate efficiently with them than you know,
do that.
And equally, you know, demonstrate by your own activity that you're prepared to do that. You know, that if it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you're standing in a cold, dark, boxing glasses up after a big event, yeah, you're the first guy there, the last guy to leave. And I'm sure they've been in operation the same thing. You don't, you know, you're prepared to do every single part of every single role in every single kitchen across the whole thing at any point in time.
This is good. I love this. This is great energy. We've had a great time in Newmarket. You have been listening to the Wine Tipster podcast. Don't forget to follow the podcast for all new episodes and follow at the Wine Tipster on social media. Join us again soon for more racing, food and drinks chat. Cheers.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.